White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. It is July 11th, 2013, and I am Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And this is episode 55 of our weekly program, and we have not missed a single week since we started, have we, Hadding?
I don't think so.
No, we haven't. And not a single week. 55 weeks now we've been going. But I think we don't want to miss because... We don't have to prepare anything big for this program. Plus, I'm always anxious to go on to the next chapter. So it's just a fun program for us, right?
Well, yes.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's interesting material.
Yes. And so we're going on with the Jews and their trade unions, the clothing unions. You know, thinking about that just for a second. Clothing, everybody wears clothes, you know. Every person in the world wears clothes. Think of the huge amount of clothing that is manufactured and sold every year. And you can be sure that Jews get into something where they're not going to run out of customers, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, what a thing they picked. And, of course, as has been expressed, I think in right here in this, that, you know, they like that because it's clean work and it's not... they don't have to exert themselves a lot, and they can. Well, there are a lot of advantages for them, so they really took it over.
Sedentary.
Yeah. Why do they live so long if they're so sedentary and they don't get much exercise? Oh, wow. Okay, so we're on chapter 50, and I'll let you read the title, but we're gonna really get into this and try to. I hope that we can have a little discussion and try to really bring it home to the listeners. How these Jews tie in with the revolution and what they're doing and how they handle these unions. It's really pretty amazing.
All right.
Okay.
Chapter 50. Jew trades link with world revolutionaries. There are more Bolsheviks in the United States than there are in Soviet Russia. Their aim is the same, and their racial character is the same. If they are not able to do here what they have done there, it is because of the greater dissemination of information, the higher degree of intelligence, and the wider diffusion of the agencies of governmental authority. Then obtains in unhappy Russia. The powerhouse of Bolshevik influence and propaganda in the United States is in the Jewish trade unions, which, almost without exception, adhere to a Bolshevik program for their respective industries and for the country as a whole. This fact is proving most embarrassing to the Jewish leaders at the present moment. It is bad enough that Russian Bolshevism should be so predominantly Jewish, but to confront the same situation in the United States is a double burden of which Jewish leaders do not know how to dispose. Yet it is difficult to see how the international Jew can be absolved either from the necessity of being confronted with it, or from the necessity of bearing sole responsibility for it. Russian Bolshevism came out of the east side of New York, where it was fostered by the encouragement, the religious, moral, and financial encouragement, of Jewish leaders. Leon Trotsky, Brownstein, was an East Sider Whether he was a member of the New York Kehila is not known. But the forces which fostered what he stood for centered in the Kehila. And both the Kehila and its associated American Jewish Committee were interested in the work he set out to do, namely, the overthrow of an established government, one of the allies of the United States in the recent war. Russian Bolshevism was helped to its objective by Jewish gold from the United States. And now that it is found to be numerically much stronger in the United States than it is in Russia, the fact causes no little embarrassment.
Well, let's talk about this for a minute. Now, of course, he wants to make out, the writers are making out that that this is really embarrassing to the Jews. And maybe at the time, you could have thought that, but in the long run, it didn't turn out that way, that they've been harmed or injured. Even though people found this out, a lot of people know it. But when you say, it's kind of like saying that the Russian Revolution was started with Leon Trotsky in New York City. It's kind of amazing, although I forget that ignores Lenin, who was always over there in Russia. But, would you go along with that, that when they talk like that? Because there's a lot of people that say that today.
Well, there was a Christian minister that testified to the Senate, I believe, that when he was in St. Petersburg in 1917, he saw a lot of Jews suddenly show up that had come there from the east side of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And that's supposedly a fact. I mean, they did, a whole bunch of them went over there from the east side of New York. Now, who then would be behind that besides, like, the Kehila people, or who else would be doing that? Unless Trotsky was in touch with the Jewish bankers and banking people, of course. Yeah, Jacob Schiff was a big promoter. He was in New York. He was a big promoter of getting rid of the Tsar. He hated the Tsar and the Russian monarchy and so on. And all these Russian Jews did, because they lived under it. They all came to the United States. It's like they all came to the United States from Russia, and then they went back to Russia after they'd been here for a while and were financed and so on.
Yeah, I'm not sure that this sentence, Russian Bolshevism was helped to its objective by Jewish gold from the United States, I'm not sure if that sentence is actually demonstrable. I think it can be demonstrated that Jacob Schiff promoted revolution in 1905. They had a failed revolution in 1905 in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But as for 1917, I'm not sure that there's any known evidence for that.
From the United States still.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So this was more early on, and it didn't work out. But, okay. I wish I had more to say about that, but I don't.
Denial is useless, for the thing is too blatant and has advertised itself too long. What amazes the student of the Jewish question in the United States is the stupidity which permitted Jewish Bolshevism to flaunt itself so openly during the past few years. The only explanation that seems at all adequate is that the Jews never dreamed that the American people would become sufficiently awake to challenge them.
See, now, I think that they're thinking that they're waking up the... Well, this next sentence says it. They think they're waking up the American people right now with these articles. But you see, the Jews were moved along, and they found ways to stop it, to stop the articles. Well, they haven't actually, because we've still got them, but, you know, they've got this, most people believe that they're not true, that they're anti-Semitism. So anyway.
The present widespread exposure of Jewish tactics in the United States has doubtless come as a surprise to the Jewish leaders. And this cannot be accounted for otherwise than that they thought they had gained too strong a grip on the American mind to make a challenge possible. It remains to be seen whether the Jewish leaders shall be able to control the Frankenstein that their false policies have created. Following exactly the program which the Jewish leaders approved for Russia, the organized Jews of New York are exhibiting a zeal and a directness which Jewish leaders would like to curb for the present, if we are to judge from some of the complaints that the Bolshevik Jews are making.
Yeah, so, but, you know, one thing I'll just say here is that when it says that they thought they had a strong grip on the American mind to make a challenge impossible, but they did have a strong grip, but not so much on the mind of, let's see, what is he saying here, but on the power structure. The Jews really, they didn't worry so much about the mind because they were busy getting a grip on the power structure. That's what I'd say. And once you got that, it didn't matter how much Americans might wake up, because they just put them back to sleep again.
Benjamin Schlesinger, president of the International Garment Workers Union, whose membership numbers 150,000, and which is a part of the New York Kehillah, is one of the complainants. His union, of course, is not the regular American labor union formed for the betterment of working conditions and wages. It is a revolutionary union for the complete change of the social system, involving also a change of government. In an interview printed in the Jewish Forward of April 8th, Schlesinger complains against the manner in which Jewish refugees have recently come to interfere with Jewish strikes. "And Jewish judges come to their assistance. They issue injunctions, and it is said that they do it to save the Jewish name, that it shall not be said that all Jews are Bolshevists. So the injunctions become a Jewish affair. We have a gigantic wide-branched Kehillah in New York. In all corners, Jews. All over, what you see and what you hear, Jews. And of course, also dress, politicians, and greater ones. But only we say this, and I understand Schlesinger. Schlesinger explains it this way. Several reasons are given why judges like..." Here a Jewish judge is named. "Twist the law. The real purpose is to break our strike. But then, after all, there is a reason, a Jewish reason, he wants to demonstrate to the American community. He claims that not all Jews are Bolshevists."
Well, did you finish that quote now?
This excerpt shows several things, that only we may say certain things, that Jewish authority is trying to cover the blemish of Bolshevism, and that this is done in order to demonstrate to the American Jewish community a certain desirable thing. The Jewish community, it is presumed, is not so easily impressed. The Kehillah is apparently trying to call in its kites, but they have apparently flown too high in the rarefied atmosphere of revolutionism.
Well, this is a little bit confusing. Now, yeah. Schlesinger is, he is complaining. He is one of the complainers about, what's he complaining about?
Complaining about restrictions on Jewish union radicalism, something like that.
Think about the man. And Jewish judges then, I remember now, Jewish judges are trying to hold back what might become criticism of Jews, they say. So the Jewish judges are sometimes, you know, on the side of those who don't like the Jewish strikes. They rule against the Jewish union striking because they think, they're saying, that will give the Jews a bad name if people see that these Jews are all Bolsheviks. You know, they're all out in the streets striking all the time. And yeah. So they say some Jews, you know, I think that this is not good for us in the long run, so they're working against us. That I don't know what the argument is here, that they don't think they should be doing that or whatever, but they say that, I don't understand. And of course, also dress. Politicians and greater ones. What does the word dress mean there? Is that a mistake?
Yeah, I didn't get that at all.
I wonder if it's a mistake. And also a dress. I don't know if something's messed up there. Yeah.
Yeah, I just shrugged and continued.
Yeah, but Schlesinger is, does he agree with the judges or not agree with the judges?
Well, my understanding initially was that he was complaining about the judges.
Okay, because he doesn't want the strikes to be broken. He wants the strikes, yeah. Alright, I think it's somebody else that I've got some information about. Okay.
In other words, the Jewish judges are siding with the system against the Jews because they don't want it to appear that all the Jews are Bolsheviks.
Right. Right, all the Jews. They don't want the American people to see the Jews as a united group. They're always trying to put across that, oh, we're a divided group and we have people thinking this way and people thinking that way, and they don't like to see that united.
It's just a simple matter of being under a lot of scrutiny, being in a high position, you know, where they can only get away with the. Can't get away with as much as if they were in an obscure position.
Yeah.
So since, you know, to some extent, they have to do the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what
another big union, which makes part of the New York Kehillah, is the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America, whose membership is about 200,000. It is officered by Russian Jews whose pronounced Bolshevik utterances have been widely reported in the Jewish press of New York, until plain and unprivileged Americans have wondered how far treason to the United States government could go on our own soil. How far treason to the United States government could go on our own soil. Sidney Hillman, the president, is one of the most radical socialists in the United States. So radical that he would probably spurn the name of socialist as ordinarily used. He is a socialist.
No, a Sovietist.
Sovietist.
Yeah.
He is so far advanced that to him the regular type of American labor union is a scab union. The purpose of the American labor union is stated to be the improvement of the workers' condition in industry and the establishment of their industrial rights, whereas the object of Hillman's union is the overthrow of industry and its communization in the hands of the radical element. That is to say, Russia over again. Hillman was born in Russia. He personally knows most of the Bolshevik Jews now ruining that great land. The secretary of the Amalgamated is Joseph Schlossberg, also born in Russia. Schlossberg has a very free gift of words. One of his promises to his Jewish followers, publicly made at Madison Square Gardens, is this. The clothing industry is ours. We are not going to permit the employer to determine where his factory shall be or how many hours we shall work. Abraham Shiplakoff, a socialist member of the New York Board of Aldermen, and next to Sidney Hillman in command of the Amalgamated, is also a free speaker, as the following excerpt will show. "We're going to move heaven and earth to educate our people that they, and they alone, are the owners of industry. The workers of Russia have found it out. God bless them. If I knew, old Sammy Gompers knew as much as that, I would tell you to go and do what the workers did in Turin. 10,000 of them marched to the factory with music and flag, and they opened the doors and went to work and said, 'To hell with the owners of the factory. Everybody knows it is a war. We are going to control the industry.'"
Yeah, that's really going far. That's really far out stuff.
Always the omission, of course, that the factories so spectacularly captured cease to run soon after. The Hillmans and the Schlossbergs and the Shiplikoffs are heroic figures on the platform. But in manufacturing, the common commodities of life and making both ends meet so that the consumer may be served and the producer rewarded, they have been the most tragic failures. "The workers of Russia have found it out. God bless them." Excuse me, God help them, he says.
Now that's what they're saying. I think that's what
the Jewish statement. The workers of Russia have found it out. God help them.
Yes.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, besides the IWW, the Amalgamated is the only organization which not only preaches Bolshevism, but actually practices it. All in the United States, and all apparently in perfect consistency with its membership in the Kehillah, and under the officership of the High Gentleman of the American Jewish Committee. The Amalgamated actually does run the industry which has mulcted such a heavy tax from the American public since 1914. They tell the factory manager where the factory is to be located. They have a minimum wage of $12 a day, independent of skill or production. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
They enforce that rule that an employee who has worked for 2 weeks has thereafter a job for life.
Wow, that's one of the terrible things.
No,
that really destroys anything and everything. They put some of that in effect in Mexico. You know, Mexico, the unions, they're not so much now, but they got so strong that, you know, the owners couldn't do anything against a union member. You know, you couldn't fire them. You couldn't make them work. You couldn't do anything. They had so many rules and regulations protecting them. That's no good. Okay.
No improved machinery can be introduced without the union's permission. The employer cannot hire even a cartage firm that the union has not first approved. The employer cannot withdraw from business unless he goes into bankruptcy. Else the whole force of the union and its allies will be marshaled against him and his. He must inform the union of all his plans in advance. This, of course, is part of the endowment of Trotsky to the East Side. He did great missionary work there while waiting to go across and take the Tsar's place. Even to this day, in the Jew-controlled theaters that crowd Broadway, the picture of Trotsky brings wild, delirious cheering, while the portrait of the President of the United States is hissed. A favorite stage scene is the Star of David, high over all flags. The recent debate between Senators King and France, said to have been organized with the assistance of two rabbis, developed into such an outrageously anti-American, pro-Soviet demonstration that prudence intervened to prevent a vote. Recently, when pro-Jewish Germans endeavored to stir up trouble by holding a great mass meeting to protest the alleged Black Horror on the Rhine, the audience was packed with Jews. Not that they love Germany more, but they love any regular government less.
Yeah, you want to talk about this Black Horror on the Rhine for a second?
Not sure what that is.
Oh, well, that's when the French forces, after World War One, occupied that German territory along the Rhine. And they brought in their colonial Algerian and other black troops to do that. And the Germans were outraged and horrified by that, you know, and they saw it as something that that they did to demonstrate the extent of their defeat. That it was just like, you know, pushing it in that they were so defeated they had to tolerate this. And, the Germans used it as a propaganda, and it really was very effective for them because they made it out, you know, they call it the Black Horror on the Rhine, and they made all this noise around the world, you know, and said that that this is what the Versailles was doing to them and so on, and it was pretty effective. But then we had all those, there were a lot of children born. There were six to eight, it says here, children numbering from 600 to 800, this is from Wiki, was the result, and that eventually, trying to say here, you know what, of course, you know, the Germans were was considered a national disgrace by the Germans, and their B grade troops, whatever. Anyway, in Mein Kampf, Hitler described the children resulting from marriage to African occupation soldiers as a contamination of the white race by Negro blood on the Rhine in the heart of Europe, unquote. And he thought the Jews were responsible for bringing Negroes into the Rhineland with the ultimate idea of bastardizing the white race, which they hate. He said, this is Hitler still. And thus lowering its cultural and political level so that the Jews might dominate. But at the end of this, it says, this is Wiki, says that 400 children of mixed parentage were arrested. I don't know if they were arrested, but they were collected and sterilized, later on. And I forget when this was done, like in 1933, after Hitler came to power, in the 30s. They went ahead and did this, and it applied only in the Rhineland. There were other African Germans in Germany, you know, but they were unaffected. They didn't go around everywhere and do this, but they did this to these ones from the Rhineland that were products of these liaisons, and because they were just thought it was so, you know, it was kind of a burr in their hide. So people will think, you know, that's just part of what people will say, oh, that was terrible Nazis. But it was terrible of the French to do what they did. And the Jews who were behind all that, too, wanting to do that. So that's what that is. And this what he's talking about here, this meeting, that he says German, I've lost my place, German, pro-Jewish Germans, they said, were at this meeting. I don't know what they mean by that. Were they Jews from Germany that they call pro-Jewish Germans or something? Anyway, I didn't much care for that phrasing. Okay.
Well, Germans had a pretty positive attitude toward Jews before the First World War.
Probably.
Yeah.
But, okay.
While a few days later, at a great American meeting, the Jews of New York, according to the testimony of incredulous observers, were most conspicuous by their absence at a great American meeting. Now, the Jewish leaders must admit that the Jewish question does not consist in American citizens uncovering these facts and helping other American citizens to become aware of them. The Jewish question inheres in the facts themselves and in Jewish responsibility for the facts. If it is anti-Semitism to say that Bolshevism in the United States is Jewish, so be it. But to unprejudiced minds, it will look very like Americanism.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're pro-American, you're going to look like you're anti-Semitic if you're really pro-American and doing the right thing.
There is not a single solitary American-born citizen serving as officer or director of those great unions which form part of the New York Kehillah. These men have not the faintest idea of what America stands for. They are not here to become Americanized, but to change America to their own model.
One more interruption here. You notice how constantly this is repeated. How many times they say in the International Jew that the Jews, at this time, that time, another time, you know, they're not trying to learn about America or become Americanized, but they want to change America. And this is so important. I think this should be repeated by all of us who work in this area of, that's what immigration, that's what all the immigrants are about nowadays. They come here, they're supposed to be allowed now to change our country, not to fit into our country. And we're the ones who have to change and make room for that and allow all these different varieties of culture and religion and national ways and languages and so on to just go on to exist here, and we're supposed to adapt to that. So this, I think this is a good argument that should be used, and they use it all the time. Okay, sorry.
In this, they have the articulated support of most of the Jewish rabbis who have been very keen to explain that Americanization does not at all mean what the American means by it. America will have become what these people want it to be when America is Sovietized, with Jewish radicals in control, and that is the objective toward which they are working now. Well, that may have seemed the case in 1921. I don't think that's exactly what they're trying to do today.
They've already accomplished it, haven't they?
No.
So they're now in their next stage.
No, that's not exactly what's what we've got here now we've got an unregulated free market, relatively unregulated free market economy and social chaos. What we've got. We don't have anything like a Soviet system.
Well, yeah,
mistake that a lot of...
Outwardly it's not, but it may in some ways, still be the same kind of program. But you're right, we're not trying to create... but we do have more and more centralized government having. More and more, the government has moved, the federal government has moved into everything. And now one of the latest things is marriage and gay marriage and the homosexual movement and so on. And they're busy pushing, that we all have to change and think this way. The government's behind that. There's something, I can't bring it up now, but something that's just very, very recent that is another example. If I think of it, I'll mention it later.
The other officers of the Amalgamated are Jacob Petrovsky, secretary, who is a Russian Jew, and J.B. Salutsky, who is also a Russian Jew and national director of the educational department, which means that he is the propagandist of the union in the United States. Regarding the assertion that the great radical unions are not officered by native-born citizens, the statement has been made that Russian Jews do not usually complete their citizenship, but stop short at the declaration of intention. There is some interesting material in a study of 2,000 presidents of Jewish organizations in New York City. Of this number, 1,054 were born in Russia, 536 in Austro-Hungary, 90 in Romania, 64 in Germany, and 4 in Palestine. These countries produced 89.1% of Jewish leaders in New York.
Wow. Think about that.
Of this number, 531 entered the country between the ages of 14 and 21, and 977 entered over the age of 21.
That's saying that they are already grown up.
Yeah.
When they came here, they weren't like little babies, you know, who are going to, you know, grow up here. They're already grown up and came with their own ideas of,
And they're very much foreigners.
Right.
Of this number, 1,270 are still under 50 years of age. These figures include all organizations from synagogues to trade unions. How far they have been Americanized or wish to be can only be judged by the policies and activities of the organizations which they direct. The big Jewish labor organizations are the direct offspring of the Jewish Socialist Bund of Russia. It is due to the propaganda of the Bund in the United States that the United Hebrew Trades have gone over to the ranks of radicalism. Bundists swarmed to the United States after the abortive revolution of 1905, at which time they failed to put Bolshevism over in Russia. And these Bundists gave their time to the Bolshevizing of the Hebrew trade unions in this country. An agitation bureau was formed, which propagated radical socialism through the medium of the Yiddish language, which is one of the official languages of the New York Kehila, made so by the demands of the Kehila's overwhelming radical constituency. The Bundists incorporated in 1905 in New York an organization known as the Workmen's Circle and, quote, swelled the ranks of the Jewish trade unions, close quote, to quote the Kehila's register. After a brief attempt to propagate socialism without reference to the Jewish question, it was given up, and in 1913 a resolution was adopted declaring that the whole purpose of the work was Jewish. This is attributed, in the Kehila record, to the spread of the idea of Jewish nationalism. Now, care would have to be exercised to avoid confusion between the Hebrew labor unions, radical as they are, and the avowed communistic bodies, if it were not for the fact that the unions and the communists are so inextricably interlocked as to make distinctions unnecessary. That this is not a judgment dictated by mere adverse attitude may be seen from the following facts. The Workmen's Circle has 800 branches throughout the United States and is officered by Jews throughout. The membership is 98% foreign-born and is Jewish in like proportion. Among the higher officers of this organization are Joseph Schlesinger, Sidney Hillman, Benjamin Schlossberg, Sam Feinstein, and J.B. Salutsky. The names will probably have become familiar to the reader by this time. They form part of the interlocking directorate so commonly found among Jewish organizations, a system which finally heads up in the executive committee of the Kehila, which also composes the leaders of the American Jewish Committee, of which the great public lights of Jewry are members. Schlesinger is president of the Union of Ladies' Garment Workers and made a trip to Russia in behalf of communism in the United States, to finance which the members of the Communist Party were assessed $1.50 each.
Okay, so the members of the Communist Party, each one had to come up, pay this special $1.50 to finance this guy's, their president's trip to Russia.
Yeah.
Huh. Wonder what they thought of that. Well, they're all Jews. You know, they say these Jewish unions were made up only of Jews. Can you think that's possible? That these ones we're talking about
now, 98% like, Jews.
Yeah, 98. He did say that. That's what he said. Amazing. So they didn't want non-Jews in their unions.
Hillman is president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. Schlossberg is secretary of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. Feinstein is secretary of the United Hebrew Trades. Salutsky is food commissar to the striking Amalgamated and is national director of Bolshevik propaganda carried out by his crowd. They are, of course, all Jews. The lineup is this. Hebrew trade union leaders are also members of the Workmen's Circle and of the Communist Party, and the majority of their trade union followers go with them into the other associations. The reverse process is this. Communism and radical Bolshevism then find their way to the consciousness of the American public by the Bolshevik demands of the so-called trade unions of Jewry. An extreme defense of all this activity might be that these Jewish leaders and workers are only enamored of the idea of Bolshevism, are playing with it academically, and are not to be considered as actively the proponents of a form of government contrary to the Constitution of the United States, and to be established by direct action. This defense, however, appears insufficient when confronted by another set of facts, in which the same union leaders and communists are shown to be in communication with the Soviet government in the United States. And the Soviet government in the United States is not a mere idea, it is a program. Moscow has repeatedly stated that the purpose of the Lenin-Trotsky government has been world revolution. And one reason for the colossal economic failure of the Soviet governmental experiment has been the Jewish Soviet leaders' neglect of their proper work to follow this fetish of world revolution. If one-tenth the effort had been made to govern and feed Russia that has been made to sow Bolshevik ideas in other countries, Russia might today have been in a less unhappy plight. Propaganda is the sole art which the Bolsheviks have mastered. This Soviet government in the United States, therefore, must be regarded as an advance post of world revolution. It is so regarded by those who know anything about it. It is so regarded by those who ordered the deportation of L.C.A.K. Martens, the Soviet ambassador. Martens was announced to be here for the purpose of opening up trade relations with the United States. He had a vast fund of gold. Indeed, it was to explain his gold hoard that he used the story about trade relations. The government of the United States judged, however, that his purpose here was world revolution, and the government was right. Martens has departed, but the Soviet embassy remains. As stated in a former article, Martens' successor is Charles Recht, who is a Russian Jew about 36 years of age. In the same building with Recht is Isaac A. Hurwitz, another Russian Jew and attorney, whose office is supposed to be the headquarters whence proceeds much of the Russian Bolshevik propaganda. Now, the people who go to the offices of Recht and Hurwitz are the same people whose names we have been tracing all through this interlocker, with some notable additions. Into the sanctum of ambassadorial Bolshevism in the United States come, of course, Recht, the representative, and Hurwitz, the attorney, for Lenin and Trotsky in this country. Another caller is Judah L. Magnes, head of the New York Kehillah. He is a rabbi without a synagogue, an extreme extremist, a master of the language of agitation, and pro-Bolshevist in his influence and associations. He is credited with being the mediator between rich Jews and radicals when the latter are in need of funds. This is the Judah L. Magnes, head of the Kehila, who tried to tell New York newspaper reporters what a weak and innocent foundling the New York Kehila is. The same Judah L. Magnes, whom the American Hebrew tried to picture as a diaphanous idealist, broken-hearted, because the ghetto doesn't fall in with his educational schemes. The Kehila is not an educational institution. It is not a welfare institution in the charitable sense. It is a nerve center of Jewish power. In Rabbi Magni's own words, a clearinghouse. And if it amounted to nothing politically and nationally, the men who are now prominent in it would soon desert it. Kehila is just what the word signifies, the whole Jewish community. Then, of course, there are Benjamin Schlesinger again, president of the Ladies' Garment Workers, and Sidney Hillman, president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, and Joseph Schlossberg, another amalgamated official whose Bolshevik utterances were quoted earlier in this article, and others of the Hebrew trades crowd whose radical relationships have been shown. In addition, there are certain immigration inspectors from Ellis Island, all Jews, of course. Occasionally, a courier from Russia who has slipped into the country for a secret purpose. Occasionally, also, a courier to Russia, bearing messages from Recht and Hurwitz.
You know, now this is something like they say that they don't say all the immigration inspectors from Ellis Island are Jews, or do they? They say certain immigration inspectors from Ellis Island, all Jews, of course. Anyway, you know, they should not have been allowed to get into that business. You know, they should not be the ones who are inspecting who comes across. That's terrible. This is a way they get away with this stuff, because nobody wants to criticize the Jews even then, or nobody wants to think that they're any different from anybody else. And you have to be proven to have done something criminal, and that's pretty hard to do when they're so good with their lawyers. But and they're so slick and slippery. But, you know, these kind of things are why we are in the shape we're in today.
Then, IWW leaders, Jews, among them Balatin, secretary of the IWW Metal Machinery Workers Branch, and Peltner, joint secretary of the IWW branches in New York. In close touch with these Jewish radicals are a number of revolutionists of other countries, representing various violent programs against the established order. It is through the office of Charles Recht that passports issued by the State Department of the Government of the United States are being viséed. This statement refers to a regular practice known to have been followed until a few days preceding this writing, and there is no reason to believe it has since been altered. Ambassador Recht, or Acting Ambassador Recht, or whatever he may be called, is in close touch with Soviet authorities and has full notice of all their intentions regarding American affairs. A frequent subject of conferences in Recht's office is the Soviet propaganda in America. Men like Hillman and Schlossberg and Schlesinger are merely liaison officers between the Soviets and the Hebrew trades unions. The orders received from Moscow are thus transmitted to the Jews in America and are obeyed along perfectly defined lines. Of course, Rabbi Magnes, head of the New York Kehillah, could hardly be expected to remain in ignorance of what the whole Kehillah knows. And that Magnes is temperamentally a radical, any two-minute perusal of his speeches will show. He is head of what Schlesinger calls the gigantic, wide-branched Kehillah, the foremost political racial organization in this country, a close community of a single racial type, which has its own code and its own customs and its own method of gaining its ends. This is not the whole story by any means. Schlesinger and Schlossberg and Hillman and the rest are leaders, but they are not the higher-ups. The connections run straight up to the lofty heights of those who dwell in palaces and sway the finances of the nation, and to those who play large parts in the government of the United States. The Jews who finance radical publications, good conservative Jews who form the standing illustration in the argumentative question, what possible gain can they hope from Bolshevism? Jews who pull official wires to gain immunity and privilege for known traitors and revolutionists. Jews who replenish the coffers of dangerous elements. It is a long story, and all of it does not require telling, for the point to be gained is not that everyone should be told, but that the involved persons should be aware that it is known, proved, safely put away, in hope that the occasion to use it may never come. However, it is due the public to tell at least a part of it. The Jewish leaders never played so stupid a card as when they endeavored to minimize the Kehillah and the place it fills. Nor did their Gentile echoes ever fall for so miserable an imposition.
Well, very good. That brings this chapter to an end, 23rd April, 1921. But, you know, I think today nobody's ever heard of the Kehillah. Nobody knows what the Kehillah is. You have to. First time I ever saw that word was reading the International Jew. And I think that's the only place, if you look it up, I mean, you find the International Jew comes up a lot. Although there is such a thing, but it was never made, you know, they were... nobody else ever exposed it in the way that they have here, and so nobody thinks anything of it. It doesn't even has never even heard of it, as I said.
Yeah, I read the word in a book by A.K. Chesterton, the son of G.K. Chesterton, called The New Unhappy Lords. I think he referred to Bernard Baruch as the head of the American Kehillah. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but I believe that's what he said.
Well, he might have had something to do with it. It was why can't I ever think of that guy's name? It's such an easy name. It's very common. You know that I keep thinking he's a judge too, but he wasn't. He was just a big...
Frankfurter?
No, the other one with a shorter name. We've talked about him a lot here too. That's too bad. Well, it doesn't really matter.
Brandeis.
No. Okay. He's got two fairly short names. He's a short guy, too. The next one you think of will probably be him. Anyway, what they're saying here, that they're hinting that there are these higher-up people who are behind all this, not these union leaders. You know, they're leaders, but they're not the ones who pull the strings. And then they say that they're in the United States government and so on. And they have all the money and they replenish the coffers. And then they say, like, well, we can put this information away and hope that we may never have to use it. Isn't that what they're saying here? What does that mean? You know, the person's, but that the involved person should be aware that it's known, I guess, that some people know who they are. But we're not going to talk about it.
That's
what is
strange.
That? Yeah. I don't like that very much. If you look up American Jewish Committee, you'll find that guy's name. I'm going to, while you're doing that, I'm going to give you some information that I found on CBS.
You want me to look up the name of the head of the Jewish American Jewish Committee at that time?
Why not? So we don't leave that unspoken. he's got a very well-known name. Sidney Hillman, you know, he interested me because he's was super radical person. And his story is, now it's typical of these guys, but maybe he's one of the worst, but he was born in Lithuania. And I guess that's considered Russia, too. I mean, all these people are considered Russian by the international Jew, and it was ruled by Russia probably at this time. I don't know. They call it Lithuania now. But in 1887, a son of Jewish parents, his grandfather was a small, his maternal grandfather was a small-scale merchant. You know, when I think about that now, at one time I thought, oh, well, he had a little business. But now I think he might have had a rug on the ground selling junk. I mean, because small-scale can be pretty small-scale. You know, you're just selling anything you can come up with. That might have been what he did. And his paternal grandfather was a rabbi. You know, he didn't have to be much to be a rabbi either. Everywhere, rabbis were everywhere. And if you knew more than the people around you, or you had studied some, the, you know, the Jewish law or whatever, then you were considered a rabbi. He was, and every synagogue had to have one or two or three, I guess. So that's his background. It was, they were impoverished, it says. And they just preferred reading and prayer to doing their running business anyway. But by 1905, he had come to identify himself with the Menshevik wing of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. And he was very active in that. You know, he was distributing leaflets and raising funds. Oops, time is almost up. And then in 1906, you know, he was involved in the Tsarist counter-revolution, caused him to go underground. And in 1907, he emigrated to America. And it took him a while to get going in America. He had to have some pretty low-life jobs for a while, but he finally got into the garment industry and took off from there. And how old was he already by then? He was already a grown man. Okay, what would you find out, Hattie? Did you find out the guy's name?
You're trying to think of Louis Marshall?
Yeah, Louis Marshall, right. Yeah, well, now what was I saying about him anyway? But he was, he was mainly known as the head of the Kehillah, along with his Judah Magnus. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have used up all of our time again, and we will be back next week with something different than the trade unions, but still going on about New York City Jews. See you then.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.